a rural development agency. Those statutes were extinguished by the creation of the department. They were extinguished, though, it was made a cabinet-level office. And in being made a cabinet-level office, it no longer carried the executive mandate that it formerly had in the governor's office. And in that position, a commissioner is in a competitive position with the rest of the cabinet in terms of priorities. And priorities rise and fall, they come and go with whatever is impinging on our collective attention in the state. For instance, right now, we all know that the commissioner of DNR is without a doubt the commissioner who carries the most responsibility and influence in the administration by virtue of the point in history where he is. And in the meantime, the commissioner of community and regional affairs is not in a position to carry out her mandate with the executive authority that office formerly had in the office of the governor. When there's an attempt, for instance, to get the data from the OTDF to try to enhance their community development component by predicting when public improvement programs or public spending is going to occur in the various communities, it tends to fail because it's not coming from the proper level of priority. And I think if you discussed this legislation with Commissioner McNamee, you would find she is quite...
I hate to interrupt, but we've got one we've got to take care of. Mr. Hogan, would you come up here and... has to do with the budget. There's one detail here we didn't take care of earlier on, and we're holding up to work.
Mr. Chairman, this deals only with language that's in the budget bill. And for those of you who have it in Section 8 of the budget bill, page 2, the provision here concerns University of Alaska reallocation of funds and how they would do that. This is part of the lawsuit that was pressed in the legislature, or excuse me, state and university are in. At this moment, it would be best to leave this language out. The motion would be to delete Section 8 of the bill. Oh, it says notwithstanding provisions of AS 370708OE, each appropriation of the University of Alaska is subject to reallocation by the university administration and the procedures established by the Board of Regents and the budget management. Presently, we established by statute last year how reallocation is going to be done. This would effectively bypass that statute that we passed last year, and of course is very important in that lawsuit before this, between the state and the university. It's best right now if you need that language.
Mr. Chairman, two items. One, this language was submitted in error by the governor when the bill was originally written. Supposedly, there is revised language coming, but this is not, they're doing more than they anticipated doing in doing this. They're nullifying the prohibition of transfer between appropriation, which was not their alleged intent. So that's one thing. The other is that it is an item in the suit as well.
Is there objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Okay, let's get back to...
Mr. Chairman, we do have a motion on the floor.
Right. And, are you ready for the question?
I am.
All those in favor of Mr. Does everybody remember what the motion was?
That was concerned.
Mr. Duncan, would you...
Page 4 between lines 6 and 7, add the words which is compatible with preservation of the subsistence economy.
You ready for the question? All those in favor signify raising the right hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Opposed? Motion carried. Is there a further amendment or discussion on the bill? We'll have to have a committee substitute.
Mr. Chairman, just one technical point. On those two changes that we previously approved, maybe I didn't hear it correctly, but the attorney's letter, am I reading correctly that he says that it's not acceptable for a legislator to hold office?
We didn't agree with that.
So you're disagreeing with that portion?
Well, I think this committee has solved the conflict by ensuring that any operating or executive action that is representative of council is carried out by the council chairman, who is an elected official in the administration, thereby resolving, I believe, the concerns of the attorney general.
But his words, if I'm reading them correctly, say, were they to accept appointment?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if you read that full paragraph there, Mr. Montgomery, it says, bill provides that members of the legislature to serve on the Rural Development Council, then vest the council with the veto power over the expenditure of federal money for rural development. As you know, the ruling in Kelly versus Hammond does not permit that arrangement. Moreover, by vesting the council with that power and with the duty of providing policy direction for the Office of Rural Development, the bill necessarily makes membership on the Commission of Public Office. We removed that power. By First Amendment, removed that power. The council no longer has the veto power over federal funds. Therefore, I would interpret that to mean it is not, would not be interpreted as holding public office. It would be just like legislators serving on any other commission that we serve on.
Okay.
One closing statement, Mr. Chairman. I believe Gordon really backed up my whole point. I don't know if he realizes he did that. It's the ineffectiveness of the department that's creating the need for this. And I think we're looking to the wrong place to fix the problem.
Mr. Chairman, I move we refer out committee substitute House Bill 932.
Is there objection?
Did you object? Yes.
All those in favor, signify by raising your right hand. Opposed? Motion carried.
Mr. Chairman, I hope that you noted that there was one illegal vote cast, and even though he's from your end of the community,
there's certain perks go with the job.
Okay.
Those young guys look all the same.
Sections 1 and 2 are really, at this point, appearing to be redundant because they're already in House Bill 60, as I understand it.
They are in House Bill 60?
That's correct. As it was last seen by the party, it was in House Bill 60. Therefore, if that intends to remain unchanged, then we recommend that those two sections be deleted from House Bill 79.
Which section?
Sections 1 and 2.
1 and 2.
Senate version?
Yes.
Senate version. They weren't in the House version.
I haven't seen the latest version.
Well, the version passed the House, they were not in.
As I understand it, that's correct.
Mr. Chairman, to make this simple, in a farm boy's language, is this bills that we've obligated for and we owe. That's what this all is?
Not as of this time. These are would be expenditures that would come on in the next 3 or 4 months.
That you either owe this or we plan to owe them under existing practice regulations, laws between now and the end of the fiscal year. This is just money we owe or we're going to owe.
That's correct.
In simple language. Thank you.
Further explanations? Questions from the committee? Mr. Duncan, sorry.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure what the other chairman wants to do on that. If this is at 60, I'm not sure he wants to have section 22. Sections 1 and 2 of this are in the pre-conference on House Bill 60. They were in the Senate version of the budget. And we hadn't even addressed that in the pre-conference yet. So we don't want to send out 1 and 2, I think.
No, I agree.
Should it be held in a couple of days? Would that be
if you decide later on that you'd rather have it in the other one, you put it there, but then you don't cut it out here on the assumption that it's going to be somewhere else.
Is there a rush since those two are in 60?
All right. If there's no objections from the committee, I think we better hold this one and do a little investigation here. Objection? All right. Let's have a look at 512. Thank you very much.
Sure. Chairman?
Mr. Duncan?
Chairman, I... doing in the bill, we're doing two things. One, we're allowing the notice in line 15, the bill allows historical districts instead of districts. Secondly, we're increasing the amount of the loan from $100,000 to $250,000. However, if there's no money available in the loan fund, so there's no real fiscal impact. Chairman, I move report out House Bill 512.
Is there objection here? No objection to order. The meeting will stand.
You want those signs?
Sign,
don't forget to sign.
And that's fine. I mean, we agree fully with the recommendation of that audit. That is duplicated. But I think in the case of these two positions, we still are retaining functions besides the audit function, namely collection, the collection and actual processing, keeping the books and payments, receiving the deposits and all that, and, which is a lease administration function. And that's what those two positions are in position to do. So.
It's the auditor. It's the difference. Well, it's a classification. We're going for field auditors. And the reason is it's the difference between doing an audit in the office, where the information you're relying on is what the companies have told you. And you accept that and initially as prima facie at face value. The oil company comes in and tells you we produced 10 million barrels last month, your royalties 125,000, and the value of that was $15. Here's your check for 15 times 125,000. Boom. You accept that at face value. You enter it into the appropriate ledgers and accounts for the book. But you don't close the books on that until you actually go out and look at the company and see what they did with the oil. What did they sell it for? What were their costs of getting it to the marketplace? And lo and behold, you may find that they said it was worth 15, but in fact they realized 17 for it. I mean, it's also like with income tax or any other tax. We take at face value initially what they report, but then we go out and do enough audits.
That's not the question. The question is, we had an auditor to beam them last year, field auditor, and account clerk type of position for us. Well, you shouldn't, I mean, I can see how you need personnel, but why would DNR still need a field auditor?
Well, I don't know what the classification of that position or the class specs on that, whether that's merely subordinate, the personnel class spec that's subordinate to the guy who's holding the auditor position now. I honestly don't know. I mean, the intent is not to have that person going out and doing the same kind of thing as revenue. The fact is there just enough volume of business to take out two people who are just keeping stuff on the books. And, so we're not, that position was not intended to end up resulting in a duplicated type function. I frankly don't remember why it was called that particular class, but at least my experience and other things is the class specs don't necessarily, at least entitle it to exactly what the person is supposed to do.
Yes, sir.
missed the last question there.
Yeah, I was saying that that position, you know, is called, I think it is called a field auditor, one new actual substantive.
You have two field auditors.
Okay, I don't know what, why that title is used, because they are in fact, you know, involved in the collection and entering the thing on the books, and what I suspect is just that the personnel system has come up with that particular class spec, and that's what they call it.
Well, my understanding is when you were given this position last year, it was intended to rectify the situation of having your field auditors just doing accounting, so that you can get somebody out to the field until this problem is solved about consolidating.
Well, I'll have to plead lack of memory on that one. I honestly don't remember. I would, if in fact we only need one person, you know, to handle the collection and enforcement parts of it, then that's fine. I would not object to transferring that position. If I could maybe get you an answer within 24 hours, would that be okay?
Yeah, that'd be okay. Just that it seems unusual that we're consolidating function. Not only are we going to save anybody, we're adding two people.
Okay, well that's true. But I think if we were talking about not only the inclusion of revenue, doing the additional auditing that's going to be necessary with NEMT, obviously, but us doing it as well, I just on the basis of what I think of right now, I don't think I'd be comfortable with merely two people. So I suspect that, you know, were that the case, and we're not counting on something like this, that we might be asking, you know, more as far as DNR goes. But I'll check and let you know if that's an, you know, if that's an accurate figure we made.
Yes. Okay. Isn't your taking on the audit function going to require you to make an interpretation of DNR's contract for the companies? And what you're going to be auditing are the expenses allowable under regulations referred to in the contract, which are DNR's regulations. Those are not the same things you're auditing under. Well, I mean, they're derived from the same information, but they're not specifically what you're going to be auditing under the
council. That's true, but the fact that to the limited extent that we would be sharing an interpretation of the details and that profits lease is not an argument for saying that we should handle the enforcement or accounting operations to see whether the lease is otherwise in compliance.
The accounting operations are just jumping the number, checking the number.
Well, there's some responsibilities associated with jumping the numbers, too. I mean, that's why those people in those pay ranges is because, in part, because
What do the audit, the accounts in DNR do, other than make sure all the numbers click?
I'm sorry?
What do the accountants in DNR and DMEM do right now, other than making sure that all the additions correct?
Well, as far as right now, not, I mean, the receipt of the money, the actual handling of the, you know, deposits, and checking to make sure that, you know, that what's been submitted is in fact, you know, at least on its face, you know, what is supposed to be done is, you know, takes up a good portion of the time.
Right? Now that is the accounting function.
Right.
Now how does that differ from what revenue does when the taxpayers come in?
Well, I mean, we are, with respect to, I mean, if you're talking about the difference between that and an audit function, I mean, an audit function is going out and taking more than, hey, this is what we're getting at face value. I mean, it's checking into it, and maybe I don't understand.
No, we already said revenue can do your auditing function. Why can't revenue take on your accounting function if it's...
Well, I think Commissioner answered that one earlier, but I mean, we have to, as the, you know, as the state's landlord, as the one that's enforcing that lease, I mean, we have to have those records, I mean, really immediately, of whether or not the companies are complying with the basic terms of the lease, I mean, at least on its face. Now, that doesn't go to the question of whether what they've submitted is true or false, but just simply knowing that they are in fact doing that on time. Now remember, these are, you know, these are extremely valuable pieces of property, and if they do not comply with the requirements that are imposed on them for paying, you know, rentals and royalties, et cetera, we have remedies, and, you know, which are well up to and including cancellation of the lease. And, you know, that's something that, I mean, that's monitoring and enforcing those leases carefully is something that I think the legislature has expressed itself on, you know, many times, and that is we better make damn sure that we're doing it. And without those kinds of records, having to depend on another department to get those indirectly, I think really, you know, would hamstring us. Standpoint of at least making sure that on its face they are complying with those leases. Because if they don't, we want to take immediate remedial action to protect the state's interest in those leases and lease terms. And I mean, that's more than just money, obviously. It's any type of of the lease term that's imposed or lease conditions that are imposed on them, whether it's wood commitments or diligence requirements or whatever, but it's, you know, to me, it's all the same thing. We are the, you know, the lessor, and we're responsible for making sure those things are complied with at all times. Mr. Rogers?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if the positions in DNR are being used to assure compliance with the lease terms, it seems to me that those ought to be kept on, given the fact that that the House was quite critical of that department and its ability to manage the leases last year at this time, and given the fact that there are more leases now and some fairly complicated ones to administer, it seems to me that those positions would have been required for just regular growth in the amount of work they have to do. And I think if DNR is going to maybe change the titles of the positions, reclassify them or something like that, and make sure that's what the people are doing is basically assuring compliance with the leases and not doing auditing, that it probably is reasonable to add these positions and hold DNR steady.
Further questions, Mr. McKinnon?
If I may, I just want to make sure, is there any question in any other members' minds as to the need for the two positions for the Department of Revenue? I know we've been talking about the positions in DNR, but do you have any doubts or would you like to have any comments on the need for the positions in
DNR? Mr. Rogers.
Considering the yesterday's signing into law of the tax bill, do you have income tax, personal income tax field auditors who could fill this position? What are you going to do with all that?
You're going to help get the forms out.
but once I get the forms out by September...
Ask me in 6 months, but right now, I don't mean to be frivolous.
Yes, I understand.
Really, there is still a lot of... There will be a reduced volume, of course, of returns will be handled. And I think you'll see, as we get over this initial crunch, we'll be able to do a more realistic assessment as to where savings can be realized. We simply, right now, haven't had a chance to analyze that and also analyze what the critical path is to getting all these forms up. I'm just not prepared or in a position to be able to answer how many positions could be diverted or could ultimately be saved. By saving, ultimately deleted from the budget. We expect there will be some. Once we get through this first crunch and have a program this year.
Is there any further comments or questions from the committee? No, thank you very much, gentlemen. Is there anyone else here?
I was just going to say, that with respect to those two positions, the last thing DNR wants is more bureaucrats than it needs. But on the other hand, we all remember that one of the debates on this net profits leasing system was in fact the administrative costs associated with it, and even though that was going to be fairly expensive, that it was, we all felt it was worth it considering the advantages of that system. And in fact, next winter we are going to be starting to deal with actual usage of net profits leases in the field. And whereas I, can't fully anticipate what those two people would be doing, I think that we need to concentrate more attention, on precisely what you said, and that is monitoring compliance with leases generally. And I'd sure like to have it, but I will. I, on the other hand, don't want to go back on something that we said last year, so I'll check it in.
No further questions. Thank you very much. Does anyone else here wish to testify on this bill? What's the wish of the committee, McKinnon?
I'd like to hold it one day. I have an amendment that I'm considering offering it.
Mr. McKinnon wants to hold the bill over till tomorrow's meeting. Is there any objection from the committee? Mr. Rogers?
I don't have an objection, but I would like to ask staff to prepare a letter of intent which asks the Department of Revenue and Department of Natural Resources to provide information to the next, on the first day of the next legislature, on the exact, the details on what each of these positions are doing and the extent, if any, of overlap.
Objections from the committee?
I'll get together with staff.
you very much. We'll hold this one over then. House Bill 354, amendment to revenue tax.
Didn't already do it. Section one of the bill is provides for a uniform civil penalty section for all chapters of Title 43. What's happened both in civil penalty and in criminal penalties is every chapter, as it was enacted over the years since 1949, had its own little separate civil penalty or criminal penalty provision. And in some cases, no provision at all. You actually did not have the authority to prosecute a person if they didn't meet the requirements of some chapter. What this section does is it establishes a common set of civil penalties, puts it in Chapter 5 of Title 43, and makes it applicable to all chapters. Section 2 of the bill is a minor change. There is two words that are being changed. This is in our confidentiality provision that currently exists in Title 43 in Chapter 5. And an issue was raised as to whether a former employee of the department, such as Mr. Duncan, divulged confidential information, whether he could be prosecuted for such an act. And since the law was not clear on that point, we're adding the words to our confidentiality statute so that both a current and a former employee of the department could be prosecuted for disclosure of confidential information. Section 3 is just to clarify an issue that's bounced around for many years about whether under our confidentiality provision
The information contained on a license that the department is required to issue is clearly public information. All we're doing is stating right in the statute that yes, in fact, it is public information. So it cannot be an issue in the future. Section 4 of the bill provides uniform provisions for our assessment of tax when a taxpayer fails to file returns, or a uniform procedure for taxpayers to file claims for refund. Turns out again, in many chapters of Title 43, there basically are no specific statute of limitations on either assessment or the filing claims for refund. Just putting in a common set that would apply to all chapters. Section 5 is, as I mentioned earlier, a set of common criminal penalties, which go into Chapter 5, applying to all chapters. These are the taken directly out of Chapter 20 right now and moved over to Chapter 5. And they cover all the different potential types of failure to file or fraudulent filing that might occur. Section 6 of the bill are out of my bailiwick. I don't know if Mr. Bett, Mr. Bett's Director of Enforcement's not here, but I know the basic intent of these is the same as all the rest of them, and that is Section 10 is also an administrative section of Title 43, and they want to have some, again, common and uniform enforcement and lien procedures that would apply to all chapters of Title 43, and that's what this next section of the bill would do, would establish those. These are basically extracted out of Chapter 20 and moved over to Chapter 10. Section 7 of the bill is dealing with the bonding requirements for non-resident taxpayers. In the past, the requirement has been that a bond or other security will be filed with the Department of Revenue that requires the approval of the Attorney General's office or the Attorney General before we could accept it. This is really, we feel, unnecessary. The Attorney General concurs it's unnecessary. He's not all that concerned about security and bonding by taxpayers. This is just a change so that the Commissioner of Revenue will have the sole authority to accept these bonds or other securities. Section 8 of the bill is correcting the tax rate schedule, which is in Chapter 20, for head of household taxpayers. As many of you will recall, in 1963, the legislature froze the tax rates for the state of Alaska and adopted a rate of 18% of the federal rates. Then in the early 70s, it was decided it would be easier to understand if we went to our own common rates. And a bill was introduced by the department at that point, and which included specific tax tables for single people, married people, and head of household. First of all, there was an error made in interpolation, and it got all the way through and never got caught when the head of household schedule was made up. And a bookkeeper last year got to calculating through these and found the error in the schedule, and first of all called Senator Ray's office, who called me and said there's an error. Of course I said, well, that couldn't be, because I was sure it was checked, and I went through it and sure enough it was wrong. So this is just to correct it. This will bring the schedule back in line with what it should have been when it was adopted in 72.
You're saying it brings up to what it should have been, but for people who earn between $38,000 and $90,000 a year, the effect of this amendment is to raise their taxes.
That is correct. In some cases it's up, in some cases it's down. It just is an average. And I should remember, this is a head of household classification, which is probably 1 to 2% of the returns filed with us. And for years from now on, it'll probably be I suppose it'll still be 1 to 2% of the returns filed, but it'll be an infinitesimally small number. There are very few people that actually meet the head of household classification or have in the past. But this will now be an exact translation from the old law. And again, as you can see, it varies in both directions, increases and in some cases decreases.
Well,
Mr. Rogers?
If it's only 1%, then we're talking about nicking them for an extra $100. The first year they filed $66, the second year, and $33 the third year. I can't see any reason. We don't need the $100.
Our concept was it should be uniform. The point was about us is we concur. Legislature is not taking definitive action.
Yeah, well, I don't mind that much nicking the people over 38,000 for the extra $100 if we can reduce the amount for the lower income people, which is what we're doing. So I just don't leave it in. And if it's making this class of taxpayers equivalent of all the other classes, I don't see any problem with it.
Right, it starts out being less, and then it goes through a section where it turns out to be a little bit more, and then it goes actually reverses into very high income where they will be paying a little bit less tax again. Section 10 of the bill is to correct a problem which has resulted from the 1968 Federal Income Tax Act, which did away with the corporate surtax exemption. Our statute was based on the federal statute. This is the provision that sets our rates for corporations. And anticipated, of course, when it was adopted several years ago, that the surtax exemption would continue on. Feds did away with the surtax exemption and adopted instead a graduated scale for taxation. So what this would do is it adds back for Alaska purposes the surtax exemption at $50,000, which is what it has been, just so our tax rates don't change. Otherwise, what would happen is corporations would have a tax rate of a flat 9.4% instead of the initial rate of 5.4%, and then after $50,000, it goes to 9.4%. Just keeps everything exactly the way it's been for the past several years. Section 11 is a uniform credit provision for Chapter 20, which, all it's adding in, the only change is there was no provision in the past for a fiduciary return to claim a credit. So there was no reference in there, so we're adding the words for individuals and fiduciary what the rate would be for receiving credit. Also in Chapter 20, we've adopted by cross-reference what is called the accumulated earnings tax, but we have never adopted a rate and put it in our statute. Section 12 would establish rates for the accumulated earnings tax and specifically enumerate them in our law. We have again gone through an interpolation computation. This will not change it, but just establishes it in our law. The next section, 13, is a section that is being amended. What the original section right now does is under the Internal Revenue Code, there are certain benefits of non-recognition that a person can take if they sell a piece of property here and turn around and acquire, like a residence is the most common. And the legislature took action, I think 3 years ago, that if a person moved out of state, they could not defer the gain, which is permissible under the code. And that they had to recognize the gains for Alaska purposes. However, not provide for a cross-reference to other sections of the code which are needed for clarity. For example, if they have to recognize the gain, then they get to adjust their basis of the new acquired property. Should they come back to Alaska or something like that. So the two additions in this section, one provides that they would adjust the basis for the gain that they do have to recognize, and secondly, would give them benefit of special capital gains treatment and so forth, which the code provides when a sale normally becomes taxable. These are just corrective measures for equity purposes to those taxpayers that we do force to report a gain that would normally not be taxable. Again, it's very complicated. We could lay out examples with a show you, but it's again trying to equalize this.
Section 14 and Section 16 of the bill are related. Section 14 was originally enacted in the law, I think, in 1975, and used the words concurrently or together, which on line 16 of page 11, consolidated or combined return, as if they were the same term. And then taxation and corporation, there are two different types of returns, and it's caused some confusion. You've had some taxpayers, corporate taxpayers, take issue with how they should be interpreted since they're used together. The consolidated return filing is a term that's defined in the Internal Revenue Code and has a very standard meaning there. A combined return concept is a concept that we use when we combine several taxpayers together that are owned or controlled by one simple corporation. So what we're doing is we're separating the terms, and 4320031E will talk about consolidated returns, and then Section 16 deals with the group of corporations that we made combined into one unitary group, and it provides for the combined return filing. Again, we should clarify this issue. Section 15 is to correct a problem which has come up as a result of a last-minute law change the legislature did, I believe, in 1976, which permitted a person who purchased a limited entry permit to deduct the price of the permit from their income tax in the year of purchase. Again, we get into one of these problems that there's different code sections that do different things. And what this does is give to the fisherman who takes advantage of that provision a double deduction, because there was no provision for the basis. In other words, basis is the term that's used to represent a person's investment in a piece of property, and a limited entry permit is a piece of property. There's no provision for reducing the basis of the permit when the person turns around and sells it. So what happens is, say somebody goes out and buys a permit for $50,000. The year they buy it, they can write that off against their tax. But when they sell it 2 years later for $60,000, they still can treat that $50,000 as if they've never gotten a tax advantage and write it off. And so they only report a gain on the $10,000 difference. And so they get a double benefit. They've rolled off the $50,000 against their income for their purchase. They also reduce their gain or subtract their basis from the sale price, and can only report a gain of $10,000 in the year of sale. This is merely to solve that problem so that they don't get the double benefit. Section 17 is to statutorily provide for what will be determined as taxable income of a fiduciary. This is another area where the Chapter 20 has never spoken specifically to how is taxable income for a fiduciary determined. And basically, administratively said, you just follow the rules that are in Chapter 20 for individuals. So the statute has never required that. Unfortunately, nobody has ever taken the task on it. All this section does is says that the income of the fiduciary is its taxable income as determined under 4331, which is the basic provision for the business. Section 18 of the bill is dealing with allowing the minimum deduction and excess itemized deductions for non-residents and part-year residents. Past, they were forced to itemize only. What this does is allows them to take the minimum deduction and the excess itemized deduction, and then it provides the next section, which is not in this bill because it's not being modified, provides for them to apportion their income to Alaska on the basis of their Alaska adjusted gross income to their adjusted gross income from all sources. That was established, I think, 2 years ago as a common formula for apportioning the minimum deduction, the excess itemized deductions to the state of Alaska. Section 19 and Section 20 proposes to use that same basic formula for attributing the
residential fuel credit and the fuel conservation credit are lesser. So the taxpayers, when they file their return, only have to use one formula for computational purposes. Right now, for these credit purposes, the people are required to afford. Section 21 does the same thing as far as credits are concerned, as far as the various credits that are allowed to taxpayers other than these two enumerated would be apportioned based on their adjusted gross income. Section 65 is a rewrite merely again for technical correction purposes of a currently existing section. The only change in this is there was a reference to the following section, section 71, and we wanted to modify it so that there was just a broad reference to other allocation apportionment formulas that might be stated anywhere in chapter 20. And then section 71 was rewritten to clarify the formula that has been in the statutes for a long time on transportation carrier for which we had a lot of problems with. And it enumerates the days import formula, which has existed since, I believe, since 1949, and clarifies a couple parts of it. The main clarity, though, is again, dealing with the three-factor formula for apportioning income for corporations. And it clarifies how the formula will be correct, will be developed. There is one correction that needs to be made to the bill on line 15. It was in the rewrite, and we didn't catch it until after House Judiciary Committee had moved the bill out. Page 15, line 10. It starts, continues, then apportioned only to those states having jurisdiction to. Right now says to the income tax. It really should say having jurisdiction to tax the income. The word tax needs to be moved to in between the words to and the. That's the only correction. Section 24 of the bill deals with the withholding rules. You may recall in the past the state of Alaska has only adopted certain provisions in the Internal Revenue Code with regard to how many withholding allowances a person can claim. There were some additional rules that have been adopted since we feel have merit. There were two that we've strongly opposed. Unfortunately, they were never adopted. Allowed people to claim withholding allowances based on itemized deductions or to be claimed to be exempt from withholding, which was a gamut that was seized by pipeline workers when the oil pipeline was being constructed, and they filing W-4s, claiming the magic number of 32 exemptions, or claiming to be exempt from withholding. Of course, their whole intent was to come up here, work, make big wages, and bail out of the state. Never pay a dime of tax. We still feel those are very important that those be excluded from our law so that when the gas pipeline comes along, we still can make sure we tax these people when they come up here to work on the pipeline. So we're adopting the other provisions of the code, but leaving out those two M and N's that give the special benefits that out-of-staters are so prone to use and have been doing. The rest of the language is really just clean up language and statute. Section 25, minor change. The law has always said that as soon as the return is filed, the department shall examine it and determine the correct amount of the tax.
Obviously, we don't examine every return and determine the correct amount of the tax. So we're just suggesting that the word shall be changed to may, recognizing that on a selective basis we will audit returns, so we're clearly not going to look at every one. The last change is there was a cross-reference that was incorrect in the statute. The cross-reference in the statute was section 280. I know what it was. It was 280 in chapter 20, which was the appeals procedure, which has been moved to chapter 5. Section 26 deals with distraint of property. The old law has been that when somebody's property has been seized and sold, a person had a right to redeem it for up to 2 years. Again, this deals with enforcement far more than my division, but the recommendation is that this be reduced to 120 days. The department goes through an exhaustive process before they ever get to the point of selling somebody's property in the first place. It takes anywhere from 6 months to a year. And so the owner has had a lot of notice already that the property is about to be sold and so forth. And so that the purchaser has some reasonable expectation that when they buy the property, they might be able to hang on to it. The law would be changed to 120 days for right of redemption. And also is modifying the interest rate if the person does redeem it so that the purchaser is adequately reimbursed for the money that they invested in a piece of property that they bought at a distraint sale, changing the interest rate from 6% to 12%. Now this would only be in the case where a person redeeming property that they sold at a distraint sale. Section 27 is merely meeting. This deals with the state taxes, and when we went to a uniform interest rate, we overlooked correcting the interest rate in this one section, which was left at 7%. We have a uniform rate in chapter 5 of 8%, so this just changes, deletes 7% and cross-references to chapter 5 and the uniform 8%, which is again all tax types in title 43.
Let me interrupt you.
Yes, sir.
I have to go to another meeting, but you wanted to move the budget out today. So let me interrupt your testimony for just a minute. I know Representative Randall wants to testify on this also. So
are you going to be testifying on this testify another day?
No, I think we're just take 5 minutes here and move the budget out so we can vote on it, or so we can get it to rules and they can schedule it. So you're
what the
deal is, we got a couple of amendments in the budget. There's a budget amendment.
556.
Excuse us for the error. 56, I think. Is that right? Yeah, get Jay so we can take the notes. Okay, there's one motion I'd like to make is to add $1.4 million into the renewable resources. Sort of a placeholder for their objection to that. Okay, motion carries. And then to reduce the number for legislative affairs to last year's figure, which is 11 million. Something like that. Yeah, 11 million. Is there objection to that?
Mr. Chairman?
Nope.
I would like to move the sum of $750,000 to be appropriated from the general fund to the office of the governor for the new capital site planning commission, AS 44-06-200, for the purpose of preparing an alternative lower cost plan for relocation of the capital, for completion of environmental studies and for other investigations.
Object.
Ready for the motion? Those in favor of the motion? 1, 2, 3, 4. Opposed? 1, 2, 3, 4. Motion fails.
Further amendments, Mr. Chairman.
Further amendments?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we put out House Bill 556. Ask unanimous consent.
Okay, no objection. Motion fails. I've signed it already. I wish I could. There's more go. move this back over to where I heard, right?
No.
All we need is signature on the report would be sent in, Mr. Jenkins.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'm nearly done. Section 28, 29, and 30 of the bill are to solve some problems that we've had with the motor fuel tax. The law, when it was enacted, provided only for refunds of the tax, specifically in the law, in the case where fuel was used in an off-highway situation. But it did not provide for situations where somebody purchases the fuel, pays the tax on it, and then uses it for some type of an exempt purpose, like buys motor fuel, diesel fuel, and uses it in their house for exempt purpose, for heating purposes. And what we've always done is administratively, we've refunded it, and we've set up the same basic guidelines for refunding in that case as used in off-highway situations. But we ended up in the court suit this year over that with a particular taxpayer, and convinced us that we really ought to change the statute so it's clear exactly what the rules are. So all we're doing is also adding in a provision for, it's in section 29, if a person obtains an order fuel which taxes been paid, the motor fuel exempt, the person is entitled to a refund, and modify slightly the procedure so that there's a uniform procedure for everybody applying for a refund of the tax. Section 31, actually it's got split slightly, 31, 34, 35, and 36 are all new sections which specifically specify the information that will be included on one of the licenses that we're required to issue, either like a fish processor's license or a cigarette tax license or a liquor license. So that again, it clarifies that information which will be considered public information. So that there is no question that the information, the information will be on the license and the fact that it will be public information. Section 32 is a cleanup in the Cigarette Tax Act. Again, just pure correction of language. Some of the old language refers to various sections of the bill, some of which have been repealed, some of which have been added to. And instead of referring to the balance of the law by numbers, we insert the word this chapter, so it's just talking about that section, that portion of the law in total. And so that's merely all those are doing. Section 33 is just doing a cross-reference on penalties. This is also the cigarette tax. It had its own penalty provisions. It now will cross-reference back to the uniform penalty provisions, which is in Chapter 5. Sections 37 and 38 are the repealers, which are all the little individual civil or criminal penalty provisions that are scattered throughout all the various chapters. We will now repeal, and then the new penalties in Chapter 5 will cover all these chapters. Section 39 is a retroactive section which makes Section 15 of the Act, this was added by the Judiciary Committee, I might add, made Section 15 of the Act retroactive to January 1, 1977. Section 15 is that section which deals with that special benefit that a person has obtained from buying a limited entry permit, where they got the double benefit. And the Judiciary Committee felt very strongly that they ought to take that back to the effective date of the other provision, so the person did not get the double benefit. 40 and 41 are just making the majority of the sections of the bill effective on January 1 of this year. The only exception to that is Section 5, which the Judiciary Committee felt should not become effective retroactively, but only prospectively, so Section 5 will become effective on the effective date of the act. Thank you.
Questions from the committee?
I'd ask just one, Mr. Chairman. Were there hearings held on scheduling here on this, some of these changes, public hearings on?
Yes, sir. We spent probably 5 or 6 hours in Judiciary going through every one of these
But when they're hearings held around the states anyway, public hearings, where you have tax changes and so on, there were no public hearings.
Again, the only tax changes are corrective. The one is the corporate income tax, which will continue the way it exactly has always been in the past several years, by reinstituting the surtax exemption, which by action of the federal law was repealed to Alaska on January 1, 1980. And if this legislature does not bring that in, that means the corporations will pay a higher rate in 1980 than they have in the past. The other tax rate change is in the area of the household tax schedule, in which there were just rounding errors, basically, is what they were in the schedule. And there was one computational error about the middle, which are being corrected so that they correspond specifically with the 1963 rates as translated using the 16% translation.
But, Chairman, normally public hearings are not held on this type of thing.
No, sir.
In other words, the publication and the notice and opportunity for input from the public on this type of legislation.
No, sir. Okay.
Other questions from the committee? If not, thank you very much.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Is there anyone else wish to testify on this bill? Mr. Randolph?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm representing Dick Randolph, and I'm having passed around the table a letter which I sent to Chairman Meekins 2 months ago now. There's one section of the bill which I feel is not headed off the direction we ought to be going. I'd like you to note that the letter that I've had passed around to you was mailed almost 2 months ago. The bill has changed some since then, so there's a few mechanical problems with the letter, but I think it does explain my concern. The concern basically is this, that for some years now, the Department of Revenue has been working under a regulation which is contrary to the statute. I'm dealing with section 24 of the bill. The regulation is directly contrary to the statute as it presently exists, 43-2170Z. And what it does, it allows the Department of Revenue to, the regulation allows the Department of Revenue to treat Alaskan taxpayers and their exemptions on their W-4 form substantially different than the federal government treats. That regulation, like I say, has been in existence for several years and has been a direct violation of the statute that presently exists. What the language in 354 does, at least in this respect, is to try to bring the statute into conformity with the regulation that they've been operating under. It sets up a substantially more restrictive situation than federal law requires. Federal IRS law does require for itemized deductions, and you can, in fact, put down more deductions than you do have dependents. And the idea of that, of course, is to make it so that people don't have to send money that they're obviously going to get back into either the federal or state government, and then the tax time get back. It just allows people to keep money that's rightfully theirs that they're going to get back at the end of the year anyway. My contention is that the state law ought to allow Alaskan taxpayers and Alaska taxes the same latitude that they have on federal taxes. Obviously, since yesterday, this is not nearly as important as it was before that.
I seem to remember something about this a couple of years back, and problems with the pipeline workers, for instance, claiming 15 dependents or whatever, not having a dime withheld, and then never filing an Alaska tax return for money they earned in the state.
Obviously, it shouldn't be able to be used in an abusive way, but there are an awful lot of Alaskans who pay a lot more taxes in than they have to, and they were allowed this latitude, as the federal government doesn't allow them. And as our statute allows them up until the passage of this bill, they can avoid it. And obviously, the department and the enforcement people of the state ought to be on top of the people who are abusing it.
Mr. Randolph, Mr. James, you're shaking your head on that. Did you wish to comment on that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I don't have a copy of the statute with me, but I have to be very conversant with this since I've been involved in it so much. And one fact you can tell by, if you look on line 17 of page 15 of the repealer, you'll notice in the brackets there, the little subsection I is being repealed. So what the current law reads is
says the rules with respect to withholding a tax set out in section 3402A to I and section 3502B, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, are adopted. A to I are the basic sections of the Internal Revenue Code which provide for exemptions or withholding allowances based on your personal exemptions, based on if you're blind, you get an extra one, if you're over 65, you get an extra one. And it has one other special allowance in it. Specifically, the legislature did not adopt those two provisions, which are subsection M and subsection N, which are being referred to, that allow for allowances based on itemized deductions or allowances, or allows a person to claim to be exempt from the tax in total. So that has never been in our statute at any time.
Question would be then, what's the need for regulation?
Regulation was merely to clarify the issue because we've had a continuing problem. What happened when the pipeline started, I for the department, wrote two different rulings which specifically said you cannot claim the excess allowances or you cannot claim to be exempt. We've had tax protesters who, in the last year and a half, have made serious noises about challenging us. Some cases they've gotten to court and then back down, so we've never had a court challenge to that position. I think we would have clearly won it. But we felt the second thing that they were doing is a lot of them were suing their employers, and the employers were not comfortable with just having a ruling from the department saying, hey, this is the way you do it. And we wanted to get the employers out of the middle, so that's why we adopted the regulations. We set forth some pretty much black and white standards that employers would follow, and that way if a tax protester came in to see them, started giving them grief, they could pull out the regulation and say, all right, there it is, that's, you know, that says exactly what I have to do. And then the idea there was, by laying down these very clear rules, if the tax protesters wanted to argue with somebody, let them come back and sue the department and argue with us. And that's why we wrote the regulations and adopted them this last year.
I guess my comment would be that my major point is that Alaska is treating Alaska taxpayers in a substantially more restrictive way than the federal government treats taxpayers.
Chairman, may I ask a question? What's the fiscal impact of this bill?
There is none.
I guess my question is,
well, may I respond and say, obviously, an increase in revenue for corporations if this is not adopted because of that rate problem, but there is no administrative problem.
I guess the point was, it's pretty well reviewed by the issue.
That's in the conference. Thank you.
Mr. Duncan.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we got a limit. I guess it needs to be made a technical amendment.
Now that was, I would consider that a technical report.
Drafting that amendment?
Drafting.
Okay. I move to report out House Bill 354 of the committee substitute ordinance here before the committee substitute and take care of the technical amendment.
Is there objection from the committee?
I suppose my previous amendment couldn't be added to this one.
I doubt it.
It would violate the civil subject rule, but I'd try it if you let me.
I don't think you've had enough time. If there's no objection.
We've got an appropriation bill coming up.
Right.
All right.
And we need public assistance for medical.
Right.
That's all right, Joe.
Got to keep trying, don't you?
There was a sudden silence. I don't know what was going on.
think you said.
No.
Okay. Everybody's been up now here, and I'm going to go for you to recess. House Bill 932, street off of the Louisville Council.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Duncan.
Chairman, this is really a bill that was introduced by the Legislative Budget Audit Committee. My request, the Budget Audit Committee last year was given certain responsibilities by the Speaker. This is one of the areas we were looking at. Gordon Stockfield, who worked on the legislation, is here. And instead of digging into it, perhaps I'll have Gordon give an overview, very brief overview, and then we can ask questions. There are also fiscal notes in your package today. One from Community Regional Affairs that shows zero, and one prepared by Milton Barker of Legislative Finance Division that shows $158,600. I hope you have a second
fiscal note. The Community and Regional Affairs note, because it was zero, I did not include in the packet.
Although
about the other one? Yeah, the other one is in
there. They don't
have it. Let me see.
Would you...
Once you proceed, we can get that. Yeah.
Just give us a brief overview, and if there's questions, then we can come back to it. I will try to make this very brief. I've included as much information in the packet as I could to explain the intent of the legislation. The concept statement pretty much outlines what this bill attempts to do. One is to provide a focus within the administration to develop an economic policy, an economic development policy. And the other, having done that, is to create a body that will tend to marshal the efforts of the various agencies and keep them basically in line with that policy. The bill, by virtue of describing the chairman as the lieutenant governor, has tapped the other elected official in the administrative branch, in the executive branch, which enables us to take advantage of the climate created by President Carter, with new emphasis on rural development, to get a far better deal than we've had in the past with the federal brokerage of Alaska Interest. Previously, all of our relationship has been brokered through Region 10, which serves Alaska, Idaho, Washington, and Oregon. And Alaska's interests have been poorly represented. Time and time again, we've tried to get some consideration of what we consider to be unique needs of Alaska, or the inappropriateness of federal programs as they're applied to Alaska, and we've gone unheard. To give you an example, CETA Title VI has been applied to Alaska to create an economy in the village areas, in the rural areas of the state, that is now completely dependent upon that continued funding. And when that funding is gone, there's leaving no structure whatsoever in its place, and that will then automatically become a state responsibility as mandated by the poll. And I think it would be probably better at this point to respond to any questions that anyone may have. Question from the committee?
Chairman, I have one.
Mr. Duncan.
Gordon, I had seen a letter a few minutes ago from the Attorney General about one section of the bill that was added. Do you have copies of that? That should be made to the committee because we need to make a change. Okay. If you want to make copies, Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, there would have to be some minor charge costs, I presume, when there for the travel. It says traveling per diem, and there are six representatives in the private sector, so there will be some for me to talk to.
Did you find the other fish?
No, I
only have one.
There should be a package in
the name. There's a separate package.
It's over in the back of it. $158,600.
Oh, okay. Oh. Okay.
be on the right-hand side of the folder, the bottom document.
Yes, sir.
Yes. In looking at its cost, we've calculated that the benefits to be derived from this could far exceed the cost of this office itself. I've enclosed an example on the right side. As you'll notice, there are many rural development funds that states are entitled to, but they're not using. As we go through that, the last example I have is a specific one with regard to Alaska, an opportunity to make use of $100 million that was appropriated nationwide for a White House rural project on small community and rural air service. An invitation was sent to the Office of the Governor and to DOTPF and was completely overlooked. Letter that we got just today from the Attorney General's office focused on potential conflict with the separation of powers. By empowering the legislative members of this council to act in any executive manner or to have any discrimination over the veto power over the use of funds, there would be a conflict. That resulted from an amendment that was added in Community and Regional Affairs, an attempt on those members' parts to give this council what they felt would be a little more power. But in the original construction of the bill, we very purposely designated the Lieutenant Governor as chairman to give it those powers. The chairman can act as an elected official from the administration, would have those executive powers and not be in conflict with his office. And if we maintain in the bill that the legislative members and private industry persons were advisory to the chairman, with the chairman being empowered to execute the recommendations of the committee, I think we would not run into problems with the Attorney General.
You agree with that, Mr. Duncan?
Yes, that's basically what the letter. Is that letter back to you?
No, it's not that way.
You have
free tattoo first.
I think they sent it out of the print shop.
We have an amendment, but it's in that letter, unfortunately.
And it did just come.
Here it is. Today. Yeah, it's right there. Okay. While we're doing that, Mr. Chairman, if I might, there is one other amendment that's been suggested by Representative Fuller and others who have very interest in the bill. And on page 2 of the bill, and I'd like to bring this out anyway for discussion by the committee, on page 2, Representative Fuller is recommending that we change the language to read on line 5, subsection 5, the advocacy of a private economy compatible with preservation of the subsistence economy should be the highest priority of the state policy. I'd like to move that amendment.
Is there objection? Hearing none, this is order. Mr. Duncan, would you move the bill to make the proper motion for the amendment?
Okay. Mr. Gavina's letter, which you now have in front of you, points out the difficulty. On page 2 of the bill, lines 7 and 8, delete. Lines 7 and 8 should be deleted. Lines 25 and 26 on page 2 should be deleted. Excuse I think we better take these as separate motions, okay? It's going to get too complicated. May I back off that, Mr. Chairman? May I withdraw that? Thank you, I'll withdraw. Line 7-8, I move that we delete line 7-8 on page 2 and renumber section 4.
A question on the amendment?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, that is section 6, it says appropriation, blah, 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 is that the same one?
Yes.
What would be the purpose of not having the appropriation concurred with by the council? That's all that says. It says that appropriations such and such may be expended only with the concurrence of the Rural Development Council. If you don't have the council, what's wrong with having them approve it?
Well, on page 1 of the letter from Mr. McGee's second paragraph, the bill provides for members of the legislature to serve on the Rural Development Council, then vest the council with the veto power over the expenditure of federal money for rural development. And then he quotes the Kelly versus Hammond case. We've gone through court on this, and we lost the case. We did not designate the power, the veto power of the expenditure of federal funds in any council. The Budget Audit Committee no longer has the veto power. The next change, I'll be on page 2, lines 25 and 26. I move the deletion of that.
Is there objection? Yes, sir. Oh, I
excuse me, Mr. Chairman, I object. I'm just reading this letter over again.
That's the one that...
I'm sorry, I made a mistake.
That's overkill on the part of the Attorney General.
I'm sorry. What he is doing here, there's no real rational basis for it. They're asking to remove the members of the legislature on the council. There's nothing constitutionally wrong with legislators serving on that council. In fact, if you want to give the council any force at all and provide legislative direction, you need them there. And I apologize to the committee for making that motion. I would just withdraw the motion.
And 25 and 26 would stay as?
Yes. Yeah. I believe that's the extent of it. I have one other motion, Mr. Chairman. On page 4, this again was a recommendation of Mr. Fulton. On page 4, lines 6 and 7, this is a recommendation of Mr. Fuller again. I'd like to add the following words. I'll read the sentences if we can read them. Act as advocate for the development of an economic base which is compatible with the preservation of the subsistence economy in rural Alaska. We're adding the words, which is compatible with preservation of the subsistence economy.
Object just for explanation. I'd like to know the reason for that.
Mr. Fuller, I think, and perhaps Mr. Schaefer, someone else can speak to this as well as I can. My understanding is that one of the concerns of the people from the rural areas and those who have worked closely with subsistence is that subsistence economy is very desirable or very needed in the rural areas of the state. And as we develop an economic base in that area, we should attempt to, along with developing an economic base, preserve the subsistence economy. That's a very basic part of their lifestyle, one that we shouldn't be overriding, it should be preserved.
By including that in the language, I don't think it restricts in any way the intent of the legislation to provide assistance to any and all communities that wish to develop their cash economy as well. It secures the interest of those communities that still have a substantial proportion of their economy dedicated to subsistence that may continue unabridged, that economic development is not going to be imposed on them to replace their local desired economy.
Hope,
Mr. McKenna.
The whole purpose of this bill is to develop the cash economy, right?
To provide a means to assist all local jurisdictions in developing their economy. Now, one of the problems that we've seen time and time again is in the federal programs, and whether it be employment programs or economic development programs or what have you, that have been imposed from outside, is they're often 100% solutions to 25% problems. For instance, in some village communities, and in fact in many of them that are still subsistence oriented, their cash economy needs are perhaps 25 to 30% of their economic problem. The rest of it is satisfied through traditional subsistence activities. And coming in with the imposition of a 100% solution, like full employment for everybody, creates its own menu of problems aside. So it's merely the insurance that the state is not empowered to impose a solution that's inappropriate to the area.
Don't have any problem with this particular bill. It seems we spend half our time around here trying to develop the economy of the bush, and the other half trying to preserve the subsistence lifestyle. And yeah, it seems as though we're putting the schizoid number on
Chairman,
our bush policy. So I don't know what.
Chairman, if I didn't subsist the two households that I took care of back home,
Mr. Chairman, I don't object to subsistence, and I support the concept, but and maybe I haven't read this bill thorough enough, but it just doesn't seem that is necessary for this particular piece of legislation. I think that's what bothers me. When you go back to the title and the purposes and the finding, I think to put this in as the first power, it doesn't quite line up with me just right. Again, I'll restate that I'm not opposed to subsistence and the problems therein, but to me it doesn't belong here. That's why I would have to vote against that amendment.
Mr. Chairman, speaking not only to the amendment, but the bill, I apologize for coming in after you started this. This is really the main thing I wanted to be in on this afternoon. I really see in reading this bill nothing that isn't already being done under the auspices of Rural and Community Development and the Department of Community and Regional Affairs. And the problem there is that job is not being done adequately. And one of the reasons is because the level of field employees is not high enough. There is a Rural Development Council, there has been, unless somewhere along the line it got abolished. Unfortunately, through the direction that the department took in the change of administration, it has dealt primarily with manpower programs and has lost sight of the direction given them to work on the economic base within the community. Since I've been in the legislature, we have upped their grants from $20,000 to $40,000 per grant to provide for community improvement and establishing an economic structure. And it seems to me that we would be better served if we would improve upon that legislation rather than create a new entity in the governor's office.
Why don't we do that when we're discussing the budget?
Okay. It wasn't in my budget unit, for one thing.
Chair, if I might respond to that just very very briefly, which is not on the amendment, I guess, but I don't know what you want to do.
It fits.
It fits. Community Regional Affairs, we're not saying, we're not casting stones at any department. Community Regional Affairs has in charge to do certain things. I think the unique thing about this legislation is it crosses, Community Regional Affairs is defined agency lines, departmental lines. The unique thing about this piece of legislation is it crosses those lines. It brings together not only Community and Regional Affairs, but Commerce and Economic Development, Department of Transportation, and others, as well as people from the private sector, as well as the as elected officials, as one advocating agency for rural development, for the CRA gets stonewalled on a lot of things. DOT gets stonewalled. Environmental conservation is stonewalled, and they never get together, and for that very reason, projects are lost. Possibilities that we could develop a very meaningful economy in many of the rural areas of the state are lost. And what this does is it brings together those agencies, crosses departmental lines, gets those agencies working together, and with an elected official at the top, in this case, the lieutenant governor at the top, it gives an added clout, if you want to call it that, to what they're really trying to do and gives them access to federal government, federal departments, and federal agencies that the Department of Community Affairs just doesn't have on its own. We're not casting stones at those departments saying that they haven't done their job, although I agree in many cases they haven't. What we're trying to do here is put together an organization, a council, an office that can really be out front, an advocate, cross those agency lines, and get the job done. And of course, you know, it hasn't been done in the past, so it's not a duplication. It's much, much more than we've ever had before. It's not a duplication. If it's a if it was a duplication, I'd be with you on it, but it's not. It surely is.
Mr. Chairman, and the way that Representative Duncan is explaining this, it's a step beyond